Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I was also really impressed with how much they got away with in this show. Like, I just took it for granted we would never see someone beheaded. Like, it would always be like a cut to the side and maybe some splash on the ground. Fuck no, we see someone full beheaded. The boiling scenes.
Yeah. And but the one thing they won't show is the seppuku, which is interesting. They just show the guy's face when he's doing it. Welcome to Bald Move Prestige, the officially unofficial podcast for Shogun. James Clavell's Shogun 1980 on NBC. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
Is NBC
the National
thing
Broadcasting
anymore?
Corporation brings you Shogun.
Tonight's feature presentation? Yeah. I don't know, man. I don't know what to call this other than just Shogun. It says James Clavell Shogun.
They put the covered all of Shogun. They put the OG in Shogun. It'd just be
that's true.
Shun without it.
Yeah, so we're here to talk about the 1980 miniseries. After having just watched the 2024 limited series, maybe that's how the distinction there. One's a miniseries, one is a limited series. I don't know where to start with this. I kind of just want to get your general impressions before we go into specifics, though. Like, overall, I will say we've only seen part one. I haven't seen parts two, three, and four, of which, and, you know, you may have a differing order of events here. It's hard to know what is the official version of this because it's been chopped and screwed so many times over the years. But the
Go ahead.
As I say, the one that we watched had four parts, and therefore we're going to have four podcasts on this. And yeah. I believe that is the DVD version.
Yeah. Because the original was five parts. This was also... regardless of which version you watch, we're going to go all the way to the events up until John Blackthorne is released from prison. That's kind of the cliffhanger fade to black that you end on and the one we watched. So if you want
to call him out, they think he's going to his death.
Yeah, yeah. So what did I think? I will say this, that and I touched about a little bit about this on the Shogun wrap up podcast, but I was kind of initially excited because like, oh, this thing was so well, you know, remembered. But then my excitement that started died when I first watched the, you know, I just hit play and there's like a 3 minute intro that has these goofy sword things where it's like katanas are unsheathing and it's revealing people's names and it gives you like 5 seconds of their screen presence. You know, it's very 80s, you know, here's all the stars credit sequence. And I'm like, oh no, oh, that's Yabushige. Oh no, that's Buntaro. Oh God, no. And I saw these people and they're just very inappropriate. Their costumes look cheap. And I'm like, this might be a terrible time. But I will say by the end of the 2.5 hours that I spent with this first episode, I came away being very impressed. No, the budget's not as lavish. No, it's not as accurate in terms of its looks. There's a lot of sets that frankly look like the off-brand Benihana.
All right.
Very, very low rent hibachi steakhouse vibes in some of these locations. But the core of what makes Shogun great is there. And there's enough interesting creative choices that make it different from this series that I feel like I'm definitely getting like shades of meaning that I didn't get because this series spent more time with this in favor of that. And I think that's going to be really fascinating to go through those differences. But I had a lot of fun, especially when Rodriguez shows up. If you really like the Anjin Rodriguez antics in this version, buckle the fuck up, because John Rhys-Davies smashes into this movie like the Kool-Aid Man, and you are on a ride for about 30 minutes with this guy, and it's highly entertaining. What about you, Jim?
But a small version of the Kool-Aid Man, because he's in his pre-Indiana Jones shape, so he's like not the big rotund portly man you think of with John Rhys-Davies. Although, I loved him. I thought he was incredible.
It's very he's very similar to his Raiders physique, you know, maybe even a touch skinnier.
Okay, yeah. That's what I was thinking. Anyway, I found this surprisingly compelling because I was like you. I'm looking at it and I'm seeing 1980s television all over this thing. From that really kind of cheesy intro that you were talking about, where they give you, you know, the names of the characters overlaid over their faces and the actors and like straight out of sitcom stuff, to the music, which is like not bad, but definitely of the era. And it's just a different style than the music you get today in a show. And I found the choices that they made sort of with the narrative interesting and in almost every way inferior to the new version. But look, this is me coming in as the guy who just watched the 2024 version and was blown away. I don't know what other choice I could have come to, right? Like, if you originally saw this one, I bet you have the exact opposite opinion. Like, oh, I really loved what they did in the 1980 version with this, and it was so much more vivid and gave us a clearer picture of who everybody was, and they ruined it in 2024. I'm thinking the exact opposite. They cut away the fat with a laser scalpel, and everything is just more streamlined.
Yeah, I will say that I found the music god-awful. I
at
just
times,
thought it was
sure.
actively interfering with my enjoyment of the music, and this the credit sequence is great because this is essentially Conan the Barbarian music that they're playing. If you know, with a little bit of gongs and chimes to give it a little oriental flavor, like the seasoning
that
packet
intro.
That you would get with a ramen noodle package, for example. That's not real shrimp, and this isn't real real Japanese
this is real
music.
Oh.
Yeah.
The acting, it's very good, though. I was really impressed by everybody in this, actually.
And that's the thing, like this John Blackthorne feels different. Like, he is an older man. He feels more like he is a lord of some sort, that he has expectations for how he's going to be treated and what he's going to be due. Whereas Cosmo felt like a young man just starting with his ambitions and much more naive about many things. Whereas this version of Blackthorne felt more worldly. And I think Richard Chamberlain plays him with an intensity that really works, you know.
Yeah, I see a lot of Cosmo Jarvis's performance being modeled after this, though. Also, I look
the
and
way
maybe that's
he
not
walks.
True. Maybe it's just the casting there was for that, because I've never seen Cosmo Jarvis in anything else.
Same.
But boy, I was looking at Richard Chamberlain and him and going, yes, I see where he studied Richard Chamberlain's performance and integrated a lot of that in his looks, in his way of speaking. There's a lot of stuff there, but I do think you're right. In tone and in character, they're a little bit different.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a little bit. I think this Blackthorne is a little bit one to be more taken seriously.
Uh-huh.
Are we ever going to have like a legit start to the discussion, or are we just going to, because it feels like we're just
dance around it for an hour and a half,
easing right into this thing. Because I thought Richard Chamberlain was really good, but you're right. The way I observed in particular, the way that Chamberlain walks, you know, with his waist slightly bent and his hands clasped at it, like it feels like Cosmo Jarvis was definitely aping some of those aspects. And when Blackthorne gets louder and more kind of emotional, you definitely saw the through line of the performance.
Oh yeah.
And there's a couple of times where Blackthorne's allowed to be more of an ignorant dumbass, which if you've only been familiar to 2024, you might be like, how is that possible? But there's a couple points where Blackthorne really feels like a child. you know, like him, I don't want to take a bath, I might get sick, or I'm not going to set foot on this slaver vessel. Like, there's where he's like almost hysterical because of he doesn't understand the cultural and customs, where I never felt that, like, Cosmo Jarvis always played Blackthorn with a bit of, you know, kind of intelligence and go with the flow. That, you know, but because he is playing younger and less experienced, that
I think that serves the character maybe a little bit better, because by the end of the story, he's going to need all of that to see him through it. So, yeah. And you'll hear me say that a lot. I think, you know, what they did in the 2024 version serves the story a little bit better. But
I was also really impressed with how much they got away with in this show. Like, I just took it for granted we would never see someone beheaded. Like, it would always be like a cut to the side and maybe some splash on the ground. Fuck no, we see someone full beheaded, the boiling scenes. Turns out that boiling scene that I remembered from a childhood, I talked about in the main cast, so it's like, oh, they just show the guy led to the pot and the screaming. No, they go back for seconds. There's second boiling. Which is the one that I remember being traumatized as a 5-year-old when I saw it. And there's like I'm like, well, maybe they boiled the guy twice to get to away from Blackthorn getting pissed on to cow him. But no, the guy gets pissed on too. Like,
yeah, yeah. And but the one thing they won't show is the seppuku, which is interesting. They just show the guy's face when he's doing it.
And it was high comedy for me.
That's got to be just an effects thing, right? Like, they can show, we've been chopping heads off in cinema for 20 years at the point that this film is made. But showing people's guts coming out is a little bit harder, more time intensive, you know?
It's just unfortunate because the way, you know, they couldn't show it graphically, so they make up and just looking at this guy's face. But the problem with the way this guy's acting choice for disemboweling himself is indistinguishable from someone having a stool struggle
or a heart attack.
This guy looks like he just spent $40 at Taco Bell. And
which could give you either of those conditions. Yeah.
And he's regretting his decisions. Like, he's going through labor. And then the guy's like looking at him, sympathy was almost kind of like, oh God, oh, can I get a courtesy flushed? Or yeah, I thought that was very silly, unfortunately.
There's a lot of kind of silly things in here. But for the most part, I thought it held up really well. And the events, the general, you know, string of events that happen, which I guess should be no surprise because they're both based off that original novel, is basically identical. There are a few differences that I want to talk about, but
yeah, here's the big one that you need to know. The costuming and the sets are not nearly as good, so that's going to be something weird. There's certainly not as much respect to the accuracy or traditions, like, you know, the seppuku that is shown, the struggle stool session, is not anything like you'd expect to see in Shogun, if you have modern sensibilities. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is they don't translate to Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
I want to start our serious in-depth discussion of this by there, because that's the biggest change, and I think that it yields, it's not a positive or a negative, it's just different.
I think it's a negative, but I'd like to hear your just different take first.
So here's the positive. The positive is it really does set you as the audience member in John Blackthorne's predicament, that people are discussing your fate and making judgments about you, and you have no say and no even real capacity to have a say in that. And I just thought that was a good effect of the choice. It really does put you in the position of this guy who's shipwrecked on this strange land. It has some big negatives, which maybe you can talk, because that's the only positive I can really think. It really draws a wall between John Blackthorne, our POV character, and everyone else around him. If there's not a translator, and you always have a question of whether the translator is telling the truth or not, and or unless the narrator, unless Orson Welles comes in to shed some light, which he does on occasion, you are left in the dark about what's going on with the Japanese hosts.
And I'm sometimes... I don't know. Those tricks of storytelling are sometimes really compelling, and sometimes I find them tedious or annoying. I didn't find this one annoying. I felt like I got what they were trying to do, but I also was thinking back to the 2024 version going, I understood all this through performance. Like, give me a little bit of credit as an audience member to use, you know, some of my empathy muscles, put myself in the situation of Blackthorn, and also have... this is the downside, also have these Japanese people be real characters, because to me, it takes so much focus away from a lot of the stuff that I really loved about the 2024 version to not understand these people's philosophies. Like, you're not going to get deep on this stuff. I can't imagine how you're going to go really deep. I mean, it's all going to have to be through Mariko's translation. And I just don't know how you get into Torunaga's real, true heart here if you never hear him in his own words. I think that's the biggest drawback, because I just don't think they're going to paint as vivid a picture of the Japanese characters. This is going to be just Blackthorn focused.
Like, when Mariko shows up for the first time, she literally just seems kind of like an airheaded, bubbly girl that's very meek and demure, and there's no, you don't know anything about her backstory or how she is with other people, or like Fuji, it's like looking at all of the Japanese characters through a keyhole, you know. And it's unfortunate because you don't get any of their interiors, you don't get any of their private thoughts and feelings. They have to have Orson Welles explain to you why Yabu, who's not Yabushiga, he's Yabu, Lord Yabu, is anxious about Hiramatsu's arrival. But the other side benefit is it does give Blackthorn's story more time to breathe. They spend no time explaining. There's never a cutaway to Yabu and Omi discussing what to do with him. There's never a going to Osaka Castle and seeing the lords fucking around there. It's like, which gives a lot of time for Blackthorn to have a lot more discussions with the priest, Father Domingo, in the prison cell. It gives a lot of time to breathe for Rodriguez and Blackthorn, which I very much enjoyed. But all that information is conveyed to us through the, you know, just you can see conversations between the Spaniards and the Portuguese, and between them and the Japanese, and between Japanese and themselves, where that this has to be told to us through exposition or other means.
I'll say it's not quite to my taste. I think the 2024 version hit a better note with that. And I'm curious, because like a lot of those things where they expand on scenes that we see in the 2024 version, like the Rodriguez stuff, and some of those things are really useful. I found those scenes pretty compelling, but then there's a lot of stuff they do with like Blackthorn's men that I found myself sort of tapping my toe going, do I really need to know anything about these guys? Because they're not significant in any way to the story, as best I can tell, having seen the new limited series. So why spend the time with it? Why spend the time to have him go to the ship to look for his rudder, which we don't do in the 2024 version? I got everything I needed to know from what they did show me in the limited series. So... yeah, so some of those changes I'm looking at going, okay, I appreciate the extra time here. And a lot of them, most of them, I would say, I'm looking at going, oh, yeah, this could all be streamlined. We could take all of this stuff out.
Yeah, especially when you're talking about the men in the bamboo prison pit. That's clearly shown to humanize and make you empathize with the Europeans and their plight. Because, you know, here these men are bravely facing death. They democratically decide to who's going to die, who gets a short straw, and they all took this oath before God. And then there's an interesting situation that happens where that gets upended because of Blackthorn's actions. And you know, your sympathies are with these men and against the Japanese, where in the 2024 series it's more of a neutral thing, you know. Because the other thing is, I think we knew that John Blackthorn was a privateer and would be considered a private by the Spanish and Portuguese. Whereas in this show, it's a lot more ambiguous about whether he is doing some villainy. There's none of that Macau stuff so far. None of the actual rudder logs that show all the raping and pillaging that him and his men have been doing. So it does feel like the Japanese are essentially the villains.
And I think because Richard Chamberlain's performance, I don't know if it's partially his accent or what, but he comes across as a more regal person, I guess, mm-hmm. as opposed to Cosmo Jarvis, who's playing this kind of gutter rat sort of guy.
Yep.
And I think that, look, I get why all this was done. It's 1980. It's American television. Like, you want some characters that Americans are going to sympathize with. And those people are going to probably have to be white and speak English, you know, at least at first, until we can sort of ease them into it. So I understand why those things were done in the series. But I think, you know, the modern sensibility and that lens, it's way better serviced in the limited series.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
Why do you think they did the double boilings?
Is it just because it happens in the book?
Because this is like the thing like that it. Breaks Blackthorne. You know, he's going to get pissed on. He's going to get like, but he's not going to be cowed. What does cow him is boiling another guy alive in front of him and saying, hey, we can do this all day long. Or you can stop being a prick. Mm-hmm. But also, I was like, can you survive being boiled?
It depends on whether it's truly boiling and for how long. I don't know.
I mean, that guy was like dipped in what I guess is boiling water, or maybe it's whale tallow or soy sauce. I saw someone say it's soy sauce, which I don't know if that's actually true or if they were making a racist joke.
Yeah, that sounds racist to me. But you have to, if
you're making this in medieval Japan, like they very well could make soy sauce this way. Like, you know, you wouldn't be making it in like little kitchen batches, right? You'd make it in
I'll
big.
I have no idea. I don't know. It must be because the book did it.
And they just kind of hint to why this is happening. Like, you see Yabu, you know, late at night, this guy's still screaming, and he's out on his balcony looking satisfied, and the camera just keeps on pulling in on him for like a 20-second scene of him listening to this man screaming, looking thoughtful. But, you know, why is he doing that? What's his deal? Is he fascinated? But you don't get any of that. It's just, it comes off as this is an evil guy who enjoys mm-hmm. listening to people scream, which is not an unfair characterization, but it goes to where he's just an evil guy. He's like the guy who owned, you know, the concentration camp commander in Schindler's List. Mm-hmm. Whereas Yabushiga, hashtag not my Yabu, he is a lot more of a well-rounded character. He's got things that recommend him. He's got things that he's got things that make him sympathetic, and he's just also just more entertaining.
So far, and I will say, I don't think Yabu was super entertaining up to this point in the limited series either. He was an intriguing character. He was kind of a villain, obviously, but we didn't really see him unfold until later, I think. Like, it's when he starts to show some of his flaws as personality flaws, not just, oh, I'm evil and I'm boiling people. It's when he starts to show, like, you know, his duplicitousness and his desperation and things, when he really unfurls as a character for me.
Yeah, I was thinking of the introduction we get to Omi, his nephew, how by the time we see him interact with Yabu, we see his mom like, come on, Omi, you got to really put your big boy pants on and impress your uncle because, and he's so much younger, like he manifestly reads like a late teenager. And this, he's very much a lord and he's large and he's in charge and he's confident and he's subservient to Yabu, but not in like, I'm, my balls just dropped and I just started shaving kind of way. More of like, oh, he's my actual lord. You don't get the subtlety of, you know, Omi impressing on him what a chip this would be. The, you know, it's a kind of left of the mystery as why Yabu has saved him. And, you know, Orson Welles comes in and tells him, oh, he's probably, you know, he's doing this to kind of curry favor with the Lord. But like, there's so much of the subtlety that you just don't get.
Yeah, you don't, his intelligence doesn't come through, right? It's just his subservience that comes through. And I think that diminishes that character a little bit. I will say the same for Naga Kato, who I guess is just Naga in this. Is that right?
Yeah.
The Toranaga's son.
And I looked into this, why they changed. Apparently, they changed it because, like, Yabu would not be the name. Like, that is just not, that's like, that'd be, it's called, like, saying, saying someone's name's Christopher and you just call him Cree. Like, that's just like, it's just like, that's not how the Japanese would do that. So they have Japanified these fictional names to make them plausible. So Yabu becomes Yabushige, Naga becomes Nagakato. And there's several characters that get that treatment, but it's not too hard to follow because I was calling Yabushige Yabu just
everybody was.
Just as a convenience
shorthand. Yeah, it's American shorthand. But Naga Kato in this is kind of portrayed in his early scenes as just, you know, a fairly competent son of a highly distinguished lord. It's way different in the limited series where he comes across as just a completely ill-equipped kind of dunce, and who withers under his father's gaze, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, he's already in command of troops, and it seems like everyone respects him. There's no hint because we don't have the cutaway scene, the his dad trying to teach him something about falconing, and we don't get how ambitious he is to get his sword wet. And, you know, this guy just seems very confident and in charge. I did like the...
Which I will say makes kind of everybody feel kind of the same, too. That's the other thing I don't like. There's no texture there with the characters. It's all just kind of like, these are the Japanese, right?
Yeah.
This is how Japanese people act. Well, no, they're also individuals.
Yeah, and I also like how... There was some of that in the 2024 Shogun. Like, you could roughly divide people into the ones that had their three hearts and eight fences fully intact, like Toranaga and Hiromatsu and Buntaro and Mariko are a lot like that. You had guys like Yabushige and Omi, who were kind of like these schemers that showed more emotion. And then, you know, but like here it's like, yes, everyone is monolithically just monotone. They talk the same. There is no difference in like, why would you like one or like another more than the rest?
It all just comes down to class, and that's it that distinguishes them.
Only the Europeans get that kind of distinction, where it's like, you know, I will say that I did just kind of like instantly like the Hiromatsu they had. He plays like a very, like a Brando as the Godfather.
Okay.
He's just kind of like big, puffy cheeks, and got the gravelly voice, and his eyes are, you know, I could see him as this kind of Godfather type person who has not only a lot of respect because of his skills, but there's also these soft skills that he has and are manifest.
I mean, I don't know how you feel about him, but the guy who's playing Yabu in this, I can see him growing into the Yabushige type character that I would really like. There are a couple of moments where he's just like, you know, he'll do a very Yabushige like bit of performance there, and I am looking forward to seeing more of him, I will say, although I don't think we're going to get quite that depth and that familiarity with the character because of the language barrier.
If I'm going with the Godfather analogy, I'd say that Yabu is coming across very Clemenza to me. He's like a toad.
Okay.
I don't know. And I did like Clemenza in The Godfather, but I like Yabushiga quite a bit more. So I want to talk about the scene, because like everything else has kind of gone chalk. If you just eliminate all of the Japanese speaking parts where they're just speaking to each other, this is very similar. There's an additional boiling. The captain survives, doesn't kill himself in the cabin, but he is deathly ill. I'm not sure why they made that change. But it all leads up to Hiramatsu coming back, and you know, again, we just got like Orson Welles coming on and saying, you know, Lord Yabu was very satisfied to have this prize that he could claim, but his satisfaction faded at a glance. And then you see, you know, Hiramatsu's galley pulling around, and they explain how it doesn't need to use sails because it's rowing and all that stuff. And, you know, you just hear that you get this all explained through Rodriguez, who, you know, John Blackthorne thinks he's being taken to the slave galley because he sees all these men oaring, and he can't imagine anyone's doing this willingly. And he thinks he's going to be on a slaver ship and sold as a slave. And Rodriguez kind of comes ashore to explain how things are going. And I got to say, I really enjoyed the expanded relationship that we get with Rodriguez and Blackthorne. And in general, I bet I feel like they do the European side of this plot much stronger than they did in Shogun 2024. Because already they're explaining some, you know, the fact that, like, yeah, Portugal and Spain are allied and they have broken up the world. But like Portugal and England have been allied for centuries at this point. And there's some friction between Spain and Portugal. And it's they're not a unified front. There's fractures in that alliance, just as there are between the Christian alliance and the non-Christian alliance on the Council of Regents. I really enjoyed that. I would like to get them to work more of that back into the 2024 version.
Yeah, I think it's simultaneously more complex, but also maybe explained a little more clearly to me, as somebody who doesn't have any information really about that whatsoever. I felt myself being very confused by the Domingo. Is that his name? Father Domingo. Yeah,
the guy that's in the prison.
Mm-hmm. In the prison, yeah. I found myself pretty perplexed by what he was saying, whereas I didn't have that trouble really here. Maybe because I had seen and we had talked about, you know, that kind of aspect of it in the 2024 coverage. But here I felt like it was just more clearly explained.
Well, also that, like, we get to see the interiors between the Spanish Catholic priest, where they're like, is that, like, when they see this Englishman sent, like, there's no, we had the secret passage. The Portugals betrayed us. Like, there's the suspicion that this is a political trick, that they are doing this because, you know, there's some power jockeying between the alliance. And you just don't get that from the 2024 thing. Like, they are a monolith the way the Japanese, I guess, are a monolith thus far. And
yeah. And probably underserved.
But I like that. I bet that I will come across, I will end this season with the ability to graft my understanding of the enhanced understanding of the Portuguese-Spanish plot into the 2024, and a lot of will make a lot more sense. And that's, I'm kind of excited about that. Also, Father Martin is a hottie. He is a daddy.
Dude, when the guy who played Father Martin in 2024 went in for the reading, he was like, oh, I've seen this. They're going to give me the best hair you've ever seen on film. And then they go in and they pull out the shaver and he's like, wait, what?
What's funny is the guy who first meets with Rodriguez, thought was going to be Father. I'm like, how did they make a guy goofier looking with a full head of hair? And then Martin shows up and he's this like calm, suave, handsome, got that gray streak in his hair, sophisticated, like, oh my God, Lady Mariko is going to have her hands full with this one, because he's just like way easier to take serious than Father Martin, who comes off as, again, like Blackthorne, younger, less experienced, more naive, less cynical. This Father Martin is pretty fucking impressive.
Oh yeah, way better. I did want to talk more about Rodriguez, because John Rhys-Davies, I'm like, nobody's shocked that John Rhys-Davies is a hell of a character to watch, right? Like, he's great in everything I've seen him in, and he's amazing here. And in kind of the same way that the Rodriguez played by, I don't know, that guy from Lost or whatever, I forget his name, in the 2024
movie. Amazing natural eyeliner.
Yeah, he's fantastic. But John Rhys-Davies is, I feel like, sort of doing his own thing, but sort of not. I mean, it's another performance that is very modeled off the 1980 version. If you told me this guy was going for a John Rhys-Davies, I'd say, yeah, probably so.
Well, and I had the questions in the 2024 version, like, where did this guy get this swagger? And like that he feels like he is like God on this ship and he can talk back to these samurai. Well, in this, it makes it clear that this guy is the pilot for goddamn Iron Fist Hiramatsu. Mm-hmm. And he is there as a representative of Lord Toranaga. So he's not going to put up with any of this shit that anybody's going to give him at this fishing village, because he knows how the Japanese society works. It all works out the reflected light of your lord. And his lord is the brightest shining thing, and he fucking knows it. That scene where he goes to escort the Anjin into his quarters and the Yabu's man tries to stop him, and he's like, I'm pilot for Hiranaga, and he's a bigger king than your little git. And it's just, and he's like half in Spanish and, or I guess English, and half in Japanese. Yeah. And he's just like, the Japanese guys don't even know what to fucking do. It's really entertaining. It tells the audience how the world works.
Yeah. And I like that he's not 100% confident that he can pull this off, right? Because like, he doesn't really have Toranaga's blessing to
get
go
ready
into
to abandon ship. Yeah, when he's about to start this,
he's like, I need to present like I have official reason to be here, and if it doesn't work, we're both dead. So get ready.
And where he's just throwing a tent, or he's like grabbing a bamboo, Toranaga-sama, as he's ripping down all this stuff. It
feels like Cosmo Jarvis might have taken a page out of that book too.
Yeah,
you know, when he's protesting the looking into the ladies' traveling chamber thing. Yeah,
if that's even a thing or how they adapt it. John Rhys-Davies.
That scene is not a thing. That Rodriguez taking him out to the boat, that's not a thing in the 2024 version.
No. Yeah,
I enjoyed like the entertainment aspect of it, but I got everything that they were trying to tell me there from the shortened version they did in 2024.
Yeah, and like I did appreciate some. Again, you get more of the Rodriguez is hard to explain just with what we know from the 2024. His kind of hot and cold feelings about the Anjin, and you know why he might have different, you know. Why is he getting himself in a storm? And it seems like where it's very much more clear here, and also that he has kind of mixed feelings about doing the priest dirty work, because he doesn't fully trust him, because the political situation is way more complicated in this story than it is. But I bet we'll be saying that the Japanese side of the story is a lot simpler. I wonder if we'll even get into the distinctions between like Lord Ono and Kiyama and Sugiyama and all that. I wonder if we'll get into that at all, or if that's just going to be, you know, essentially boiled down to Toranaga versus Ishida, with Ichiba being the...
A lot of this, I look at it and I go, I know that has to be in the book, so they kind of have to do it. But with this format, I don't know how they're going to. So it'll be interesting to see.
I could talk a lot about the Rodriguez stuff, because, again, John Rhys-Davies is so likable and he's so larger than life, and he does such a great job. And the line about, you're a pilot by God and all pilots should love all other pilots. Am I right? And just how they've got this kind of... are you familiar with the term E4 Mafia?
No.
So this is in military culture, which I find fascinating, but you have, you know, the two branches in each service. You got the officer corps, who are the guys that, you know, like are dedicated to telling other people what to do and leading the men. And you've got the enlisted. These are the men that just volunteer not to be officers. And like, you know, you got the ranks 01, which is your lieutenant or your ensign in the Navy, all the way to like 09, which is a 4-star general. And the E's have the same thing. You got E1, which is your just basic private or your sailor. And then you go all the way to E9, which is like your master sergeants of the Marines and all that kind of stuff. The E4 apparently is the spot where you have enough experience to kind of know what's going on in your service, but you don't have enough authority to be given real responsibilities. And that's also where a lot of the specialists, like, you know, the one that have like gunneries and weapon specialists and equipment specialists and people have very highly technical training. And that this they call themselves the E4 Mafia because they essentially know enough to kind of sham, like, hey, if I just walk around with a frown on my face with a clipboard, no one's going to stop me for KP duty. Or if I get in bad with this guy, I can always go rob, I can go steal 3 shovels from this other infantry unit to make up for our and get in good. And I feel like the pilots are like the E4 Mafia of this universe. Like, they have a very, they don't have any real authority, but also you can't really just tell them to do scut work. And they also have a bunch of arcane knowledge that can always spit back on you, whether they want to do this or that. And this guy gets them all in trouble because he wants his bonus for getting to Osaka early. And that's why he kind of acts like a crazy person in a storm.
Yeah, I guess so. That's the thing in the show. You know, the 2024 version, I didn't feel like Rodriguez was intentionally trying to throw Blackthorn overboard, though in this, I think Nate wrote in and told us about that, that, yeah, there's a very different, like, vibe between them in this. There's a little bit more of, I didn't feel it in the modern version until the scene where Rodriguez is laid up and he reveals that he found the rudder, right?
Yes.
Then I felt like, oh, Rodriguez is not your friend. Rodriguez acts like he's your friend. There is some camaraderie because of your pilot status, but he is a mercenary and he is his own man, and don't trust him. In this, I feel it way earlier.
Yeah,
and more, I guess, intentionally. But yeah, I do appreciate those scenes because it's just a thrill to watch Jonathan Rhys Davies do his thing. And I hope we get more of him than we did in the 2024 version. Because I would say if there's one character in the modern version that I feel was underserviced, it's Rodriguez. I wanted more of him, and I never got it.
Everybody else, showed,
I wanted more of, and I did get.
I bet we get the race scene, like at least that. But I agree. Every time in the 2024 where he'd show up and he'd be like, God damn that Englishman, you just got. You'd be like, oh, I hope they get. And it never quite took off, but... I will say that a shame, and this is almost certainly due to budgetary restrictions, is they omitted the cliff sequence where Rodriguez gets swept over and Yabushiga has to, like, this is just Blackthorn jumps in to save him, and Yabu, not to be shamed, like, and apparently who can swim like an Olympic swimmer, just joins in to kind of get some of the credit too. But that him having to face his death and Blackthorn kind of like really understanding for the first time what these guys are all about, that's completely missing. It happens on the boat.
Yeah, I think he gets a sense of like how maybe brave the Japanese can be, but not what it means, you know?
Yeah.
And I felt like, yeah, because Yabu doesn't have to, you know, put a sword to his belly and you know, kind of tempt that fate.
Didn't even really struggle. Yeah.
No, he doesn't really struggle much. I feel like there's a big thing lost there that I'm sure they'll fill in another place. But yeah,
I have to. But yeah, you get like there's like an appreciation between Blackthorn and Yabu after this, but it's not nearly as well developed as it is, I believe, in the book and certainly this. And like I said, I understand they didn't want to have a new location. They spent God knows how much money. On this ship boat, set, on this water tank that it's like, it's good for its age, but you can clearly tell this is just on a one-way gimbal rocking back and forth. And
yeah.
And it's a soundstage.
Yeah, it's just a big swimming pool inside of a stage. And, you know, you can be forgiven. It's 1980s television budget. So it feels epic for its place and time.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is an exciting scene. It's just not nearly, you know, I've seen Master and Commander and The Perfect Storm and Titanic and
right. Once they start filming on open water, then now we're talking.
Right. It's also really interesting how they show Seppuku because the first time we're shown it, this guy, you know, when they, you know, Blackthorn convinces all the guys are in the pit to fight, like, we're not going to meekly accept one of our persons for sacrifice. We're going to fight them as one. And they get their asses kicked, and they are managed to keep one guy hostage. But this guy loses so much face from getting taken by the English people that he never leaves the pit. And eventually, I believe it's Omi comes by and just throws him. Was it a Wazakazi? Is that the short katana? And
I only know Daito and Shoto. I couldn't tell
and
you.
And he's not. There's no ceremony. There's no death poem. There's no, you've got until sunrise tomorrow. There's no second, crucially.
No second. Blackthorn doesn't even see it.
Blackthorn doesn't see it. This guy doesn't even take his robe off. The reveal
Omi
his belly.
Omi doesn't stay around to see it.
No,
that was the insult.
That's what I'm saying. This is a very sensationalized, salacious version of seppuku, which it's already kind of a sensationalized, salacious when we look at it from a Western perspective. But
that's the thing. This is for Westerners. This is for the audience. This is not for John Blackthorne. This is not for Omi. It's just for the audience, because in 1980, not a lot of people knew anything in America knew anything about Japanese culture, I would say. Most they knew is like kamikaze pilots, right?
Yeah. And there's also like that scene with Omi taking the peasant's head off. It's much more gross in the 80s miniseries, because it's like in the 2024, it's like these Christians are very concerned with one of their Christian men being, and they're like trying to give last rites, and Omi's like back off, and the one guy's trying to cross himself, doesn't get on his knees quick enough, and he just takes his head off. Whereas this, the guy's looking there like, what are you gonna do if I don't fucking bow? And it's the guy's head's off, and then it's just you got this reaction shot of Blackthorn going, oh, and the Portuguese priest going, oh, and the music going bing bong, telling you, oh my god, these people are crazy.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. But I mean, it's understandable too, right? Like, anime hadn't come over yet. People weren't eating sushi in every single shop across the country. Like, we just didn't know.
Apparently,
we're ignorant, culturally ignorant.
People track down the birth of sushi and the hibachi
in America
to Shogun. And that made me think, it's like,
really?
Well,
wow. Yeah.
When I say that these sets look like low rent Benihana, I wonder how many Benihanas took their look from these sets.
So it's like
you go in the Bamboo Garden, and it looks like Shogun because everyone thought, well, that's authentic Japanese. And when you actually see authentic medieval Japanese in FX's Shogun, you're like, oh god, this is like a Chinese buffet. It's not even the right continent.
So it's effectively an introduction of this Japanese custom to Americans. And I think it's fairly effective as that, right? It's kind of bewildering to us. This man goes down in a hole. He tries to disobey his lord's orders, and for it he's told to kill himself. That's wild. So strange.
But it's like the version, we wouldn't bat an eye if a high-ranking general went into a colonel's office and put a pistol on his desk and be like, hey, you're either gonna be court-martialed and been prisoner rest of your life, or like, oh, okay, we get that.
And then there's all this talk about, you know, how there's one punishment in Japan, whether you spill a rice bowl or you try to assassinate a shogun, and it's death, you know?
Yeah.
Which I'm almost certain is not true, but let's go with it.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't a joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. And now, back with more Bald Move. We already said to talk about the relation. This is the part where we have an extended scene of the priest discussing the barbarian and worried about him, you know, unfeathering the nest that they're making for themselves. But you get that idea that Spain and Portugal have this very rocky relationship. And it's also reinforced because Blackthorne mentions that, hey, you know, you mean the English natural allies. We've had the Portuguese back for centuries at this point. I guess that the mutual support treaty between English and the England and Portugal against Spain, where they basically had a treaty, is like, if Spain ever fucks with us, we're going to fuck with them together. That's like one of the oldest treaties in Europe.
Okay. Boy.
Yeah, and I think it's the oldest extant, because I believe it's still in effect. It's the oldest extant treaty in the world. Which I don't know if it says something about Spanish behavior back in the era, but that, I think that's much more interesting that these people, there are fractures in this alliance for Torunaga to exploit if he understood them as well as there are on the Japanese side.
Yeah, you're right. I will say I was not super impressed by Osaka when we first saw it. Like, there's that scene I remember from the 2024, which is beautiful.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And they make the point of saying, hey, there's a scene coming up of Osaka. Make sure you watch it. That's essentially what, is it Yabu? Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's Rodriguez says that to Jonathan Blackthorne. So when he comes up to Osaka, I'm thinking, oh, here we go. And it's just like a castle that you can kind of see in a distance on a hill. That's it.
And it reminds me, it's so exactly like in my, the Monty Python's The Holy Grail, where they go to Camelot and everyone's like, Camelot, and then the one guy's like, it's just a model. That's exactly the vibe you get when you see Osaka for the first time.
There's no pan over the city. I mean, it's so beautiful.
There is no city. It's just a castle.
Yeah, it's just a castle.
I guess they did. They just filmed this beautiful castle in Japan and, you know, no one else had seen it. So it's like, oh, wow. Yeah, that's that looks nicer than a lot of castles we've seen, and like Excalibur and things that are kind of all run down and ruiny and damp. And this is just bright, beautiful, almost like a, it has much more in common with like the Sleeping Beauty Castle at Disneyland or Snow White's. I'm not sure which is which. I don't care. But like, it's very, it's got this pastel blue roofs and it's off on this beautiful hill and it's, everything's green and lush around it. It's an impressive castle, but it's not like, oh, imagine the lord of this city compared to London. It's, it's nothing like that.
Yeah.
I think that this is the Mariko being a secret translator, I thought was an interesting change. The fact that Torinaga was kind of testing out Father Martin for, you know, I thought that was, you know, the fact that, you know, he's got his back to him and he doesn't see Mariko sneak in and whispering in his ear. I thought that was a positive change. It does add another facet to Torinaga, which this Torinaga desperately seems, because by the time we meet Torinaga in the 2024 series, we know a lot about him and his whole deal and how he interacts with his men and how they feel about it. This is literally the first time we see him, and they are trusting that Toshiro Mifune can play the gravitas of this Japanese daimyo, and he does. Like, like, if you know anything about Toshiro Mifune, he was Kurosawa's number one guy. Like, if you've seen Rashomon or The Hidden Fortress, Throne of Blood, Yojimbo, any of those things, he is the samurai in those things, and tons of others. Like, he worked with them all throughout his life, and widely considered one of the greatest actors of all time, and he brings the goods in just the little things that we see him in. But I like that change that he's sneaky. They really, you know, he's trying things.
It's I guess I didn't read that as super sneaky. I read it very similarly to how I read the 2024 version. Like, oh, he's got this translator that they don't quite trust. He brings in his other translator. Everybody knows that everybody can translate in this room, so no one can really speak falsely. It didn't feel like a test here either, which is kind of what I was wanting out of it. And I thought they had set that up really, you know, interestingly in the 2024 version, where they could have done that, but they didn't.
Well, they'd have to translate some Japanese because there's no way to show that, because if they told it to Father Martin, then the jig's up and they can't tell it's us because we're too stupid to speak Japanese. So.
Right. And I will say, you know, everybody expected Mifune to be able to bring something to this, and he does. Like, if there's one actor in this I expected to be good, it's him.
I was like, I heard Richard Chamberlain's pretty good, and yeah, he is. And actually, almost everyone is excellent. But that's the one thing, like, I had no worries at all about.
No. Even though, you know, I love the performance that... Jesus, what is his name?
Sanada.
Hiroyuki Sanada.
Yeah.
I want to say they also wait a hell of a long time to introduce Mariko in this version, which I think really underserves her so far in this story, because we know a lot about her as well. Like, we don't know her backstory and like why she is the way she is, but we know what type of person she is. In this, she just comes across as a translator. There's a person that he keeps around that, so that he can verify translations.
But a lightweight. Like, she's like a kind of comes across as an airheaded girl who's Twitter-pated by John and just kind of giggles and blushes. And like, Mariko, at this point, we've already seen her negotiate the situation with Fuji's husband and child and let her be the last hands. And, like, we see how much respect she commands, not just from the women, but for the men. Like, she backs off those samurai, too. Here, she just seems like a total, like, accessory to Torinaga and not... You know, there's also the hair and makeup and costuming. I can't say enough about how shitty so much of this stuff is, and how shitty the costumes look, how poorly tailored they are, just how fucking Globe Theater Shakespeare some of the shit that they got Blackthorn in looks like.
If they just do a way better job with the shaved scalp prosthetics in the new version, or if
that's
they're
also
just
so bad, the wigs,
they're terrible. But in the new version, I fully believe that people might have shaved their heads for it, And in this version, I'm like, well, there weren't a lot of people in 1980 willing to rock that hairstyle, even if they were in the movies.
That's a tough one.
And there's a lot of headbands hiding the seam between the prosthetic and the actual forehead, I noticed. The makeup.
They're not bad looking, like this in some of them, but they're just okay. Cheap. Everything's very cheap. Yeah. And man, you see a lot of just brown togas that look like they were sewed out of like the low thread count sheets that you get at like the Great Value. They don't fold well. They're when Mariko walks away from John for the first time, he's looking at him for you can't help but notice how creased and wrinkled when you see Mariko walk and she's got those perfect crisp lines and her feet are just like that, everything works together to create this effect of this impressive person. Whereas this Mariko looks like she sleeps in her costume. It's just not as good. Some shockingly bad tailors and seams. And I don't think I'd even notice this, except for I just saw how excellent everything is. It's like watching Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Rings, and then seeing a high school musical version of it. It's like, there's a lot of pleather.
You can't get away with that now.
There's a lot of felt passing for, you know, what is the, like the really tufted material. I don't know. But yeah, there's a lot of substitutions for much more expensive fabrics, and there's things that are prints that should have been embroidered. And
I blame Marvel for not being able to do that anymore. Once they took the spandex superhero costume and remade it into something that was like believable, really
real
good
world. Yeah.
Then everybody's got to start up in their game.
And you know, you could feel the chill in all the scenes in Japan because it is, or you know, late winter, early spring. You don't get any of that. This is all like bright sun and everybody's wearing. It might even be that he doesn't want people to die of heat exhaustion because they're trying to film all this in Burbank, California.
I will say the introduction of Toranaga is good, but I felt like the show did it a disservice because you get the introductory scene of the most important character in my mind in the entire show, and you're going to cut to commercial in the middle of it. Do you see that fade to black and fade back up?
The conversation
continues like it never stopped.
Honestly, I didn't notice a lot of the commercial breaks. I noticed some of the big ones, you know, like when they're leading the guy to be boiled for the first time, they really made a deal of that. But no, I didn't. The ones that are just kind of interstitial like that, I didn't.
Wow. Okay. I couldn't help but notice it because you just don't see commercial breaks in that form anymore, where they'll like fade down to black.
Yeah.
And the one other thing I want to talk about in this Toranaga scene is the unless you win line. Because there's a pretty big line in the show, I think, overall. And here it's spoken aloud in front of everyone. And Toranaga reacts to it aloud in front of everyone. And I think it's interesting because all the stuff we don't get into Toranaga's viewpoint because of the language barrier here, I think this actually helps that a little bit. You can see him sort of revealing his second heart, right? Not his third heart here, but his second one. Because he laughs aloud. He lets the whole room know that he appreciates that viewpoint and then comments on it. Says, yes, you've identified the one loophole. I thought that was significant.
The one he's driving through. Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
No, it's good. And I understand why people question why they, you know, the Toranaga in the 2024 version was much more subdued. But it's because we already it's almost like gallows humor in the 2024. Where it's like this guy fucking thinks the same shit I do. And also just having Richard Chamberlain be an older, more established, more regal character makes Toranaga and him much more like peers. Where in the series, Toranaga is like 30 years older and he sees Blackthorn as just like maybe a little bit more worldly than his son and more capable of his son. But he doesn't take him as serious because he just doesn't have the life experience. He's more amusing. So just casting Chamberlain in their role, I think you pull off that like these guys could be peers more than just perpetual student master or bait hunter. You know, Falcon Fist type of relationship that they have in the series.
Yeah.
I want to talk about another scene that's quite different, or at least it's so much more expanded, which is John Blackthorn in prison. Since we don't have any Japanese POV, we're just stuck there in prison with him. And him seeing, there's this really terrible scene of a guy throwing up a can of Campbell's chunky beef stew. Mm-hmm. And again, it's just like the guy slicing open his belly. I feel like this is the exact same performance they give on South Park whenever when someone throws up. It's like this kind of just very fake throwing up. And this guy is like clearly got his mouth full of pea soup and he's I thought that was very funny. But I appreciated the political and religious and philosophical discussions that Blackthorne and Father Domingo have here. And they also make it a point that I think is in the books, but less so in the 2024 series, that one of Blackthorne's special abilities is how rapidly he can assimilate culture and language. They kind of started off the same path where you find out he's a polyglot and he, you know, knows a lot more than you'd let on. But I think they're going to overcome this translation problem by just having Blackthorne become proficient in Japanese way quicker in this material.
I do wonder. Yeah. I was wondering, is there ever going to be a change where they start subtitling things because Blackthorne now understands them? Or is it just going to be that through him, you know, we kind of understand the Japanese, you know, ideas. I found it interesting that, like, the difference, that there's a subtle difference in Blackthorne in these two versions, in my mind, when it comes to, like, learning the language. In the new version, it almost feels utilitarian. Like, I'm stuck here. I need to know how to say this particular thing. How do I say this? And over time, you know, he's obviously going to pick some of those things up. Here, it feels like it's much more intentional. Like, I want to learn how to say these things, not I need to use that word right now. Teach me about the language. Teach me about the culture. And maybe that comes through just in the performance, maybe. But to me, it also lended, you know, an air of like intelligence and something else to Blackthorne.
I will say that that's the part of the prison scene that really started to drag for me. When they started getting to the teaching Japanese part, I'm like, oh my God, I've been watching this shit for this scene. The prison scene feels like 45 minutes, and it's just like, that's just tedious. Like, when you're like, seconds, you hold up a pot. What do you call this? It's a pot. I know, but like every second of it felt like it was torture because I'd already felt like those scenes were starting to drag on a little bit. And that's everything. Yeah. The pacing is so much statelier in this because you don't have those cutaways to Omi and Yabu having these like really interesting conversations, or Mariko and Toranaga and Hiramatsu, or Ashido in the council. You don't get, so it's just Blackthorne. And when Blackthorne's stuck in a prison with nothing to do but watch people die, there are some interesting things with you know, they have Blackthorne having this thing where he feels responsible for people's death. Like, there's this one guy who defends him from this guy trying to steal his rice bowl, and then Blackthorne feels impotent to do anything when he looks over him sadly when his name is called. And he's a lot less cocksure. Like, in the 2024 version, Blackthorne just always thinks he's going to figure out, this is not where I'm going to die. Whereas this, Blackthorne feels a lot more terrified that, oh God, I am going to die. Mm-hmm. This is...
Which you would be if you'd seen your friends boiled in front of you, you know?
Yes, and you'd seen these people that, you know, you spark up these friendships in prison, and you kind of like, you know, and then they die, and Father Domingo certainly thinks they're going to die. And that's episode.
Yeah, I don't think it's all 2024 is better across the board. I think there are some differences that are just different. There are some things in the 1980 version that I like more. I'm just really curious to see how they go forward with this without subtitles.
Yeah, honestly, that's my big takeaway, is that I am impressed that I got... that I was worried that I was going to see this and be like, oh man, it's going to be really tough doing the other three. But I think that it is a valuable experience. I don't think I will never say it's as good as the 2024 version.
No.
But it is illuminating certain things that I think that the things that we thought the 2024 were weak on, like the fact that the Spanish Portuguese stuff was just such a sketch, just to barely make the plot work. Well, now the Japanese are getting that treatment, and the Spanish and Portuguese are allowed to kind of breathe, and that's good. And I like, you know, I want more Rodriguez in the 2024 series. I'm getting more Rodriguez, played by John Rhys-Davies in his prime. And just, yeah, all the performances are much better, with the possible exception of Mariko. I'm not sure how the 30 seconds I've seen of this Mariko and her characterization, how the hell she can pull off the material that the 2024 one does. But she could have a different gear. Maybe she's presenting the timid, airheaded geisha as a way to ingratiate herself with Blackthorn and take, you know, the advantage of him and have him drop his guard. Because that's the other thing, is like Blackthorn is much more ladies than Cosmo ever plays him in this version. Yeah, yeah. Like, he eye fucks every single attractive Japanese person that he can. That's a female and pulse and under 40, and under 40. He is getting the range to his cannon calibrated on second. your mast raises above the horizon.
I have a prediction for you.
Yeah,
I think you're going to come to appreciate this version of Yabu. Maybe not as much as Yabushige in the modern.
Well, there's
one,
no
but,
fucking way. Yeah.
Yeah. But. Yeah. Because he's amazing. But I think this guy has it. There is a couple of looks that he gives that I'm like, yes, he can pull off this material and it's going to be a joy to watch when he does.
There was that, you know, especially when you can see his satisfaction turn to frustration, like, you know, when Orson Welles is telling us that there were a few hints where I could see in him interacting with Hiramatsu, even that long sequence he has just reacting to the man's torture. Like, I think now that I know what Yabu's going on in his head,
well,
because I've seen the miniseries, it informs it. But like, yeah, I can definitely see, you know, I can definitely see the book version, probably the 2024 version, shining behind. And when I just saw him just sitting there like a bloated frog in the intro sequence, I didn't see that. So, yeah, maybe.
I will say, I think this whole watch is going to be highly informed and enhanced by having seen the 2024 version, because I don't know that I would get half of what's going on here, and I would understand these characters at all, perhaps, by the time this show is over, unless I had seen that.
I'm going to predict that it's better, because you're making out like it's a David Lynch Dune, where it's like it's going to be largely incomprehensible, but visually engaging and performances. But like, because the thing is, this was well regarded. This is like the second most successful miniseries of all fucking time. The David Lynch Dune was kind of a flop on arrival because people were like, we don't get it. People got Shogun and it was engaging, compelling. And
I just think it's going to be just way less deep because you don't have the insights into the characters as strongly as you do. But that's my guess. I'm really open to being pleasantly surprised.
Up until the last two decades or so, that's always been the book versus film, book versus television, that like, God, it's just like it's got the greatest hits, but it's only been in kind of the golden age of movie adaptations and TV adaptations. We're getting to where they're kind of parody, or even some might be better in some ways than others, you know?
Sure.
But I'm glad I saw this version, which seems like it's going to provide a lot of background and it's going to allow what they're trying to do, the Japanese characters, to come through much, much more. Well, I think that's as John Blackthorne's getting out of prison and we're out of topics. I think that's a great way for us to end our discussion of the first part of the Shogun miniseries. Again, the version that we're seeing is in four parts. I wish I had thought to look ahead to the next segment to know where we're going to stop, but I don't know when the next one's going to stop, but we'll talk about that up front. And like I said, there's no concept of spoilers at this point if you've seen Shogun in 2024, and if you haven't, what the hell are you starting with this one first for? But we'll be back next week to talk about the second part of Shogun 1980. Hope you've enjoyed this discussion. Shogun at baldmove.com if you want to get some feedback in the retro rewatch we're doing here. And also support.baldmove.com if you'd like to help us keep doing what we're doing and get some nice bonus features for yourself. Follow us at all social medias at baldmove. That's going to be it until next week. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.